Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 63 of the Book Exchange podcast. My name is John Lovell, coming from Maryland. And as always, I have my co-host on the line here. His name's Jude Lovell. He's in Pennsylvania. We're glad to be here with another episode. I think this is going to be an interesting one. So thank you for joining us. Jude, thank you for joining us. How's it going?
Pretty good. Yeah, I'm ready to roll. I got a drink here, and I'm ready to get going. So let's do it.
All right. I hope that's a real drink and not like
it's a real drink. Oh, yeah.
Excellent. Well, we're recording in the evening, which we don't always do, but that just is the way it worked out this time. We've been off for a couple of weeks. Not going to get into that. It's just, you know, usual foibles of life here. But I'm very excited. We have an interesting topic tonight to tackle that I think is going to be a little bit different than some of our most recent episodes. It's, X is a very important letter here on the Book Exchange podcast. As you well know, Jude, you know, the exchange is with it. It begins with an X, and that is an homage to where we went to school, Xavier University, et cetera. But tonight, you know, it's a double X episode. That's my
cheesy. That's a good one.
that's my cheesy setup. Tonight's topic, it focuses on female characters. We're calling this our most memorable female characters episode. So that's the entire focus. We've gone through kind of our own personal histories of reading and books and writers, tried to identify who have been the most memorable and interesting female characters that have stayed with us. And there's all kinds of reasons why that's an interesting subject, but, you know, we're going to get into it shortly here. This is one of these ideas that just kind of came up and we batted it around. And then when we started to work on it, I think it's safe to say, you know, we both, you know, found some surprises along the way, and, we're going to get into it, as I said. So I think it's going to be fun to kind of kick this topic around. You don't get this everywhere, folks, but you do get it here on the Book Exchange podcast, an entire episode dedicated to our most memorable female characters. We're a couple of dudes here. So, you know, we're going to do our best, bring our perspective to the table. But I know, kind of thinking through some of my choices, I have some interesting ones, and they're books that I got quite a lot out of, which we'll, you know, unpack here shortly. So is there anything else? Is there anything you'd like to say about the topic, Jude, before we get started with our regular program?
Well, maybe just a couple general comments. You know, like you said, we're a couple of dudes. We're like these twin brothers, these twin white brothers. We're going to be kind of galumphing around in this topic like a couple of bulls in China shop or whatever. Not that we're that big, but we're certainly, you know, qualify on the clumsy or, you know, clunky front with this particular topic. But, you know, like, you know, I think I choose to look at it, you know, seriously, and also just like, you know, we're sort of in a way paying homage to, you know, our sisters and as we move throughout life, you know, who's not interested in the opposite sex, you know, and how they work.
Right.
And you know, that's something that everybody can relate to. You know, I certainly feel like I'm going to stumble around a little bit, but I have to say, just by way of introduction, when I went through this process, it was I had a lot of surprises. You know, I kind of struggled to come up with characters to speak about. I'll try to get into why that is. I don't know if it's necessarily like a liability, but it might be. You know, like I mean, we can talk about it. You know, and then at some point we were calling it our favorite female characters, and then we moved to our most memorable female characters because, at least in my own case, there are some surprises, and not all of them are very virtuous or people that you necessarily want to know. So, you know, we'll get into that, but it's just going to be interesting. And I think you just have to approach, you know, a discussion like this just with your mind as open as possible and just try to, you know, sort of bat around the way we do with every literary topic and just kind of see where we're at, you know, at the end, you know. So it's going to be interesting. I'm looking forward to it. I've already had a lot of revelation, so it's going to be wild. So let's go.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the open mind, because it gives me a chance to bring up one of my favorite life principles, which I didn't make up, not by any stretch, but I got from one of my favorite writers, Mr. G.K. Chesterton. And I share this with my kids all the time. In fact, to the extent that they're all sick of hearing it, but you know, that I don't know if it originated with him, but it's where I first read it, where he says, you know, the mind is like a parachute. It works best if it's open, you know? Right. So I find that applies to a lot of situations in life, but certainly, right. You know, absolutely going into this topic with an open mind, as you know, we like to think of ourselves, you know, I say this humbly on this podcast, as open readers, meaning open to all types of literature in all its forms, all kinds of voices. And that's kind of a sort of a unspoken, even though I just spoke it, unspoken sort of guiding principle to just kind of how we do things here on the Book Exchange podcast. But I'm glad you brought up, you know, it's sort of semantics in a way, but the idea that we were going to call this our favorite female characters and we switch it to most memorable. But, you know, what we're saying is not every one of these characters is somebody you might emulate. But, you know, they all have in some way stuck with us. And those are, you know, I find to be the most interesting characters that you encounter throughout your entire reading life. The ones that stay with you, the ones that puzzle you, the ones that you kind of go back to and just think, yeah, you know, man, you know, what was up with so-and-so? So those are the kinds of characters we're going to be talking about. It's sure to be an interesting discussion, and that's all we need to really do to set the table. Most people listening to this podcast, they know how to get in touch with us. Email address, bookexchangetwins, that's exchangetwins, all one word, @gmail.com. Please give us a positive review if you enjoy the show. And I think with that, unless you have anything else you want to interrupt with, you know, we're going to go into the first part of our show as normal, which is where we talk about just what we're reading now. So instead of handing it to you, I'm just going to start off myself. How about that?
Go for it.
So I've told you about this a little bit. I'm right in the middle of a riveting book. Just absolutely, I'll just say that right out of the gate. Absolutely riveting and fascinating book. It's a narrative nonfiction book. It's called The Tiger. And I've forgotten the subtitle. It has something to do with a true story of vengeance and survival. That is the subtitle. And it's written by a man named John Valent. I'm not quite sure how to say his name, but man, this is an incredible book. I'm about halfway through it, and it just has me, you know, it reads like a white knuckle thriller, but it all happens to be true. And it's just a fascinating, you know, I could go on and on about it, but it, you know, maybe I'll talk about it later in the show's future. We'll see. But it's a story of a very remote region in the far, far east of Russia. Basically, weirdly, it's part of Russia, Jude, but if you can picture it, and you may not be able to, it's east of China, but part of Russia, and kind of across a fairly large sea from Japan. So it's all the way on the eastern side of Russia, a small province that's part of Siberia.
Wow.
And in this province, there's a certain type of tiger, which, you know, most of us, if we know anything about tigers at all, we associate tigers with, like, you know, tropical or jungle lands. This is a totally, totally different type of tiger. You know, what has in the past been called a Siberian tiger. But there's a certain type of tiger that essentially, you know, he sort of sets the scene. He kind of situates you in a very, very small sort of rural, dirt poor hunter's community way, way out there in the middle of nowhere. And all of a sudden, some of the local hunters and trappers, and in some cases poachers, are being, out of nowhere, attacked by these enormous, tigers, which are, I was going to say Siberian, but that's not really what they're called. But and it's essentially, the book is sort of an investigation. It follows an investigation as to why this is happening. But then it, you know, it's also a fascinating sort of travelogue book about this part of Russia, its topography, its natural history, but also its place in Russian history. and, you know, its ties to the rest of Russian country. And then it inevitably gets into, you know, criminal activity in terms of poaching and, you know, illegal trading and hunting of parts of tigers and exporting them to China. And, you know, it broadens out into this, like, really just a riveting, in one sense, it's sort of like a crime story. In another sense, it's kind of like a investigation or almost like a police procedural. But it also kind of immerses you into some of the literal backwaters of Russian history. It's absolutely fascinating. I've never read anything quite like it. And, you know, I'm still very much in the middle of it. So I really have no idea why these, like, the tables have turned, essentially, and the tigers are hunting the men, and it's something they've never done before, and nobody there has any idea why. And it's just like, wow. I mean, it is like reading a thriller movie. It's incredible. So as you can hear, I'm enjoying the hell out of it. And I knew it was going to be interesting and that I would learn something, but I had no idea it would be as enthralling as it is. So that's what I'm reading.
And real quick, John, tell our listeners how you got anywhere near that book.
Well, you're putting me on the spot a little because I'm trying to remember exactly how I got there. I think, you know, I enjoy reading books about nature and animals. And I don't know if I came across an article that was a review of the book, or I think I may have just seen it on a list of, like, books you can't miss if you enjoy reading about, you know, the animal kingdom or something like that. But it, you know, I stumbled across it, had never heard of it. Apparently it was an international bestseller, but it just sailed right by me. And as soon as I read sort of a brief description of it, I was just like, man, I got to check that out. And that's how I got to it.
Yeah. It's like, sometimes you read an article or something and this happened to me recently. Where somebody says, you know, the writer says something like, you know, that this was covered in such and such's great book, XYZ. And you just kind of stumble on, you go, why are they describing it as, you know, a great book? And then you look it up and then you just go down this rabbit hole and somehow, you know, things get discovered that way. But, yeah, I was just asking because, like, you know, I just haven't, you know, ever since you told me that you were picking it up, I was like, where did that book come from? You know, like, I mean, it's so JFL, it's so John Lovell, you know, but it's really out there, you know, like geographically and, you know.
Yeah.
And I'd never heard of it. And but since you started reading it, I mean, the you know, I know you and, like, your texts were, like, dripping with enthusiasm and, like, you know, like, as you're describing it now. And I was like, man, this is really, you know, I smell a top 10 list. We, you know, we might get into that down the road, you know.
Yeah. It's just a completely insane story.
Yeah. Like, I probably don't even appreciate just how crazy it is. But, you know, interestingly enough, you and I were talking off camera. And we'll move on, but, like, about, you know, we've already learned about the fact that there's different, very wildly different species of tigers in the world. When we, you know, earlier this year, we I think we touched on this podcast somewhere, that the novel The Hunter by Julia Lee from about the Tasmanian tiger.
That's right.
The guy hunting down the Tasmanian tiger, you know, which is a whole different animal, literally. So anyway, you know, like the tiger world, who knew there was such a variance in the tiger world? But I'm sure there is, as there probably is with any other species. But
and just to whet your appetite here a little further, like there's some debate as to whether this animal even is a tiger. Like, there are people who vehemently insist that this animal has somehow survived from, like, the Pliocene era. And it's actually more like a saber-toothed cat, you know, like, which the author of this book kind of debunks, but it just shows, like, how mysterious this particular type of tiger it is. And yeah, we're going to move on, but it was not lost on me that this is, like, I don't know why. This is just pure, you know, serendipity or chance, but this is, like, the second really riveting book that I've read this year about hunting after a certain, you know, obscure type of tiger, which is really weird.
Yeah, well, that's John Lovell for you, friends. Yeah, and I wonder if the fiercest of the of those particular tigers are the female ones, but that's I guess we're not going to get into that here. You know, I mean, who knows?
Well, it does. Well, the book does say, actually, interesting you say that. The book does say at one point that the local people refer to any type of tiger there as a she, as like the way you refer to ships, as like she did this or she's a good girl or
which is
just sort of interesting given what the subject of this episode is. But anyway, enough about tigers. We need to move on to what you're currently, you know, immersed in right now.
Well, it's interesting, John, because we both happen to be reading books that we're absolutely riveted by, you know, but then they're totally different down the lines of what you and I like reading. So I'm absolutely enthralled with the book I'm reading right now, too. I'm a little over halfway. I've told you, but I haven't even told you to the full extent, because you gave me the book very recently for our 53rd birthday last month. The book is called, there was this British science fiction, eco fiction pioneer, a writer by the name of John Wyndham. And he was most famous for a book that was turned into a movie in the 50s, like a horror movie called Day of the Triffids.
Yeah.
In which the plants came alive and started attacking people. But he actually wrote many very interesting novels that most of them had something to do with the world around us or the ecology or something like that. Another book that's famous by him is called The Chrysalids, which you read. I've never read. I did read Day of the Triffids. And John, for our birthday, gave me there was this one publishing house. I think it was Vintage or, you know, something that decided to reissue some of John Wyndham's back catalog. And so John gave me a brand new, a very handsome version of John Wyndham's second novel, which is called The Kraken Wakes. And this thing is an absolute gem. It's about a 225-page book. I'm a little over halfway through it. And it's great for many reasons, you know, but it's this cracking, you know, eco thriller. You'd have to call it an eco thriller, but it came out in the early 1950s. It's way ahead of its time, as John Wyndham was, particularly with eco stories or, you know, books about, you know, novels about our environment, you know. In this case, it's based on the fascinating premise that he came up with tells the story of an alien invasion, but where the aliens invade planet Earth but decide not to invade the terraform places on Earth, the land, but decide instead to invade the ocean. And so these aliens come from outer space and ensconce themselves in the deepest portions of the deepest trenches of the oceans covering the world. And nobody knows why they're there. Nobody has actually seen them except in the vaguest of ways with the technology that exists at the time, cameras going down these trenches and stuff, seeing, you know, these blobs kind of made out of light. Huge forms, but they really can't make out anything else. They don't know what they're there. And then all of a sudden they start like – basically sinking ships and attacking from below, from the ocean. And, man, it is just a riveting story. It's beautifully written. I read Day of the Triffids, and I have to admit, I wasn't all that impressed with it. Like, it was an interesting story, but I remember just being kind of slow and a little bit boring. This book is not slow at all. It's totally engrossing. It's wildly mysterious. And at the same time, it features these two characters, a husband and wife, who are married, and they're involved in a fictional organization called the EBC, which is kind of like the Philadelphia to BBC in Britain is New York, you know, EBC in Britain is like Philly, you know, like the younger brother, the one that's not quite as accomplished. They work for this EBC outfit, and they're both kind of writers and reporters, and they have this hilarious, like, salty rapport, kind of like that couple in – remember the movie Misery with that couple that's like investigating, you know, the writer who disappeared, and they're always kind of like bantering with each other?
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
Yep.
That's what Wyndham decided to do in this book. I don't know where that comes from, maybe his own life or something like that. This husband and wife are investigating it from the kind of like journalistic, you know, and writing point of view. You know, at one point they're writing a documentary about it, and they kind of continually go back and forth in a humorous but like very smart, it's like repartee, like witty repartee. And that forms a very enjoyable element of the book, but the book is wildly mysterious. You have absolutely no idea what these aliens are or what they're doing, and just the whole and it makes another really interesting choice. It doesn't really show you the aliens. Like they, when they first are spotted, they're like these vague forms in the sky, and then they splash into the ocean. Nobody really gets a good look at them, and then they go so far deep that they can't be observed or found. You know, so it's a riveting book, and I'm enjoying it way more than I even thought I would. So the book is called The Kraken Wakes, and it's by John Wyndham. There you go.
Yeah, I'm thrilled that you're enjoying it as much as you are, because that was the hope, as it always is when we give each other, you know, these book exchange selections that we take a lot of time and care, you know, to think about and choose. So I'm glad that it seems to have landed, you know, like, and I'm thinking, like, isn't this basically like the plot of the Guillermo del Toro movie, Pacific Rim? Isn't that what happens? Like, there's like these alien creatures that come from below. They get like woken up by seismic activity or something, just starting.
Yeah, a little bit. Like, but then they come out and are very visible. And in this book, they're not visible. They're just causing all this mayhem and destruction. And then there's this whole like Cold War angle, because like the Western countries are blaming it on Russia, and Russia's like, we're not doing it. It's just lots of fascinating elements that are part of the 20th century, but he wove them together in a marvelous way, if you ask me.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. I'm just saying that, you know, Guillermo, our buddy Guillermo, needs to, you know, cut a check to the John Wyndham estate. You know what I'm saying?
Right, yeah.
He was there a lot earlier. But anyway, that sounds like an awesome book, and it's fun. It's just fun, too, every once in a while to dive back into, like, you know, take a deep dive into, like, genre fiction, like crime or science fiction. That just adds a whole other element of fun to it as well.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, that's what we're reading. I hope everyone out there is reading something good. And now, you know, we're just basically going to transition to our main topic here. Dude, as I told you, as we were getting ready to record tonight, you know, I don't have any fancy setup question. There's no hard curveball that you're going to whiff on or anything like that. I think, you know, we both prepared like a list of, you know, a handful of memorable female characters that have just stuck out to us. So we're just going to talk about them. You know, I really don't have any overarching, you know, clever things to say about the topic that we haven't already said. You know, I think this is going to be just sort of an open discussion. And, you know, we'll probably along the way get into why maybe it was difficult to put this list together. But what do you think? Do you have a character that you want to start off with, or would you rather me start? How are you feeling?
Well, I only really landed on four of them, and then I have, like, some honorable mentions. And that in itself was kind of revealing to me, because I went back over the last 20, 25 years of my reading list, because I keep notes of the books that I read. And I really tried to look over the whole thing and think of, like, which were the female characters that really stood out to me, you know?
Yeah.
And my list was pretty sparse. And I was like, why is this the case? And then, you know, so I mean, like you said, we could kind of cover, like, what happened during our process with this as kind of we move along. So I have a list of four. I could start just by talking about the first character, if you think that would be the best way to go.
Sure, why not?
Okay. So, again, I have four, and then my choice number five, if you will, is going to be kind of a potpourri, or, like, you know, whatever you call it, with some other characters that stood out to me. And when I go through my list, I'm going to be talking about virtually all of my characters are from books that have been discussed more than once on this podcast, you know, in one form or another. So one is from a series, but we've talked about the series. So the first character for me is her name was Mariette Baptiste. And she's the kind of protagonist of a book that I mentioned in the very first episode of this podcast, John, called The Books That Made Us. Mm-hmm. Fiction. When we talked about the fiction books that made us, you know, kind of made us, meaning like kind of, you know, formed us, you know, into the readers we are and kind of stuck with us the longest kind of thing.
Yep.
So Mariette Baptiste is the protagonist of Ron Hansen's novel from 1991 called Mariette and Ecstasy, which I often cite as, like, not my all-time favorite novels, but definitely in the top three for me. And we've talked about it on this podcast and a number of times. You know, so just like in a very brief explanation of the book, like, Mariette Baptiste is this young woman living in upstate New York in 1906 at the start of the novel, and she's about 18 years old, and she happens to be a beautiful young woman. She decides that she is going to give herself over to the Lord, to God, and enter a Christian, a Catholic, what's the word I want? Nunnery.
Convent.
Convent, thank you. She decides she's going to join a fictional order of nuns in a convent in upstate New York in 1906 and devote her life to God. So she does that in this very short and poetic novel written by Ron Hansen, one of my favorite writers. And basically what happens is she really shakes up the convent with her kind of mystery and her aura and her beauty. And she captivates all the nuns that are in the order. And in a short, about a third of the way into the book, she comes down with, or is like, I guess, afflicted with the wounds of the stigmata, meaning the, you know, Christ's wounds from being crucified on the cross, which, you know, pardon my French or the turn of phrase, but like all hell breaks loose inside this convent. Mm-hmm. And there's like a schism that happens. Like they're divided down the lines of, is she a fraud or is this a real holy mystical event that's happening? So then that's the book. Like the rest of the book kind of, there's an investigation and it proceeds and then it, you know, ends, you know, spoiler alert, in an indeterminate manner for the reader to kind of figure out in their own mind kind of what happened. And this is, you know, like I said, one of my all-time favorite books for many reasons. But one of the reasons is just the character, Mariette, is this, you know, Ron Hansen in a very poetic and I think very accomplished and competent, you know, exceptional way manages to communicate, you know, the fetching quality of this young woman, the beauty of this young woman in very short spaces in the beginning of the book. And you kind of get sort of wrapped up in her, at least I did. I mean, I'm a male reader. I don't know if a female reader would. And so you kind of get caught up in her anyway. And then, you know, the stigmata is visited upon her and she becomes this very mysterious and nebulous figure. And what I loved about her, just to try to keep it short, is that, and what made her so memorable to me is that you never know. You never know if she's a fraud or not, John, in this book. And she kind of gets under your skin. She says very little. And then there's like these interrogations that happen in the book. I don't know if you remember the one scene where the investigator and Ron Hansen just adds these very short little snippets of the interviews instead of this long interview over 10 pages. You just get little snippets. And one time the investigator, who's probably a man, probably a priest or a bishop or something, says like, you know, were you in ecstasy at this particular time? And she says like, is it for me to say, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's lots of, and that's her whole answer. And there's lots of interview snippets like that. And you get the other characters who are nuns at Rage and Age from 18 or 19, the same age as Mariette, all the way to like age 100. And they're all just like either really riveted by this young woman or sort of repelled by her, but they have strong reactions all the way through the book. And you kind of experience this character through their eyes as well. So I just found this character totally fascinating because you just couldn't figure out where to land on her, you know, all the way through to the very last page of the book. And I thought it was an amazing character building performance by Ron Hansen. So that's my first, Mariette Baptiste from Mariette and Ecstasy.
Yeah, that's a great pick. That's a great way to kick this discussion off because it's such a beautifully written book. The book is a mystery. The book touches on spiritual themes, as you've already said. And you just can't quite get a handle on the main character. And to say she's slippery would be kind of a disservice. There's something mysterious going on with her. You can still hear me, right?
I can.
Okay. And that maintains that edge of mystery is maintained through the entire book, as you've said. What you didn't specifically say, or unless I missed it, is that he also imbues her with sort of a strangely seductive sort of sensuality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you did mention that she's physically beautiful. He makes a point to point that out, but not in a salacious way. I mean, I think there's something going on interesting there because there's a whole, you know, many of the church's mystics, in particular female mystics, and I'm not an expert here, you know, have described, you know, spiritual experiences in kind of sensual or almost sexual language.
Yeah, I think Hansen's, or like eroticism.
That's right. I think, you know, there's a very famous statue of Teresa of Avila. Everybody's seen it, or most people have seen it. And she's kind of, she has this glossed over look on her face and her mouth is open. And basically she looks like she's in ecstasy or on the edge of like orgasm or something, you know, like,
right. And is that the one that's on the cover of the book, John?
I believe so. It's definitely on the cover of My Life of Teresa of Avila, which is a book, a fascinating book that has stayed with me too. But anyway, yeah. So he deliberately weaves that element in there. It's all the way. It's right there on the last page, Jude, as you know. So that just further, maybe it may, again, you mentioned that we're male readers. I don't know if it would have the same effect on a female reader, but that just adds to this sort of like, you know, I hate to say it, but like allure of the character. Mm-hmm. And there's just, it's just an uneasy brew, but a compelling one. So I think it's a great choice. And it also just sort of helps introduce that, you know, a lot of these characters we're going to talk about, I know on my list are quite complex, you know, as most of us are, and certainly most women. No. Just kidding.
Yeah.
Just kidding. The little rim shot. But you
well,
know,
at least to you and I, but like, yeah, but I mean, most people are though, you know?
Well, and also like you mentioned in the outset of this discussion, like, you know, most of us are intrigued by the opposite sex, not the least of which is because we're trying to understand them, how they work, you know?
Yeah, I mean, John, not to interrupt you, but Neil Peart of Rush just talked about this in the song Different Strengths. When he's talking about, Entree New, forgive me, Rush fans. We talked about we're weird planets to each other, kind of revolving around one another. Anyway, I work that in when I can.
Yeah, you got to work in Rush wherever you can. Anyway, that's a great choice. I'm going to, you know, to keep this rolling along, I'm going to mention my first female, most memorable female character. This was the one that just immediately popped into my head, you know, absolutely right out of the gate. I knew I was going to be talking about this particular character and this series of books. Like you said, with Mariette and Ecstasy, these are books that have come up before on the podcast. I was trying to remember when I may have mentioned them, like you said, all the way back in the first episode. I certainly probably did when we had our episode about our favorite female writers, which was back in the first 10 or 12 episodes, I believe. I think I have that right, don't I?
Episode 5, for those of you who want to go back and research it.
So, and if I were ranking these, this would probably be my number one, although that's, you know, that's... on any given day, it might be different, but one of my favorite characters in all of literature is a character named Kristen Lovren's daughter. And she's the titular character of a trilogy of novels that were written by the great Norwegian writer, female writer, Sigrid Undset. She won the Nobel Prize in 1928. This is kind of her magnum opus, although she wrote many books. She wrote this is a trilogy. The Kristen Lovren's daughter books are a trilogy. She wrote a tetralogy, you know, which is four books. That was also very well received. She wrote a number of books. But this is pretty much her most famous and most lasting contribution to literature. And it tells a story. It's set in medieval Norway in the 14th century. And it tells a story of basically a willful and headstrong and intelligent and spirited young woman named Kristen Lovren's daughter. And it basically follows her life from when she's a young girl with her parents and family. And throughout the course of three books, we see her, because it's the Middle Ages, she is betrothed to a certain young man that she does not want to marry. And she defies her parents' wishes. And, you know, the Catholic faith that her family, that she was born into, that her family practices is a very prominent part of this entire trilogy. So she defies the wishes of her parents. She defies the wishes of her church and decides instead to marry somebody that is a man that she's more attracted to, that she's drawn to, that's very handsome, but has a little bit of a sketchier path. Not sketchy, but he has just sort of, you know, he's been around a little bit longer. He's already been married once, his father, and, you know, kind of immediately doesn't really approve of him. But Kristen Lovren's daughter decides to marry him anyway because she has fallen head over heels for this guy. And really the rest of the trilogy is about, it's kind of like, you know, the ramifications or how this choice in her life as she's just becoming, you know, a woman, coming into womanhood, sort of reverberates out. And then what the rest of her life is like because of this one crucial choice that she made. And so it follows the story of her marriage to this man who's named Erland. They have seven, she has seven sons with him. She has a very, you know, like a large and complicated family life. But she, throughout her life, struggles with, you know, feelings of guilt, number one, about how she defied her parents' wishes, but also feeling like maybe, you know, there are many times in her life where she's not sure she made the right choice in terms of who she decided to marry. And the reason why I love this character, she is such a complex character, and it's one of the most, of all the characters I've ever read, of any gender, she's one of the most relatable and credible characters that I've ever spent time with, which is really interesting because she's Norwegian and the story's set in the Middle Ages. You wouldn't think there's a lot to grab hold of for a 21st century middle-aged male like me or any reader in the 21st century, but these books have a timeless feel. They're really, it's an incredibly layered and complex and earthy and real portrait of a woman's marriage and her life and the struggles of her life, her struggles with being a mother, her struggles with her parents and her relationship with her parents, and certainly her relation, her complex relationship with her own husband. And it doesn't sound, when you describe it to people, it doesn't sound like a lot. But I've never read, I don't think I've ever read a series of fictional books that felt so true to me in the way that marriages have ups and downs, relationships, even with somebody you've known for decades, can be complex. Huge problems and tragedies happen in your life, and you're wrestling with how to deal with them, and you're joined. If you're a married person, you're joined to the person you married. And you may have disagreements over how to handle these problems. And this series of this trilogy of books is just so down to earth and real. I find it to be just full of wisdom and a really kind of a deep dive into the whole idea of marriage and family commitment. And you're seeing it all through the eyes of this very interesting and complex woman, and her life just continues to get more complex as she goes along, and you sort of follow her with it. She never has all the answers. She's plagued with doubts. She has flaws. She has a lot of spirit. She has many skills, and you just kind of follow along with her all throughout her life. And then her life in the third book takes a pretty radical turn after she loses her husband, which I'm not going to give away. But she sort of, she ends up dedicating her life to the service of others. And it's just this wonderfully complex portrait of a woman just dealing with the challenging realities of life And I just find the books to be full of wisdom, full of warmth, full of really strong values. And I just love this character. So, you know, I could go on and on and on. But certainly if you're someone who's drawn to literature with spiritual themes or complex family relationships or portrayals of marriage, you absolutely, you just cannot miss this trilogy. It's an all-world trilogy for a reason. So she is probably my favorite female character that I've ever read. And I know, I think you've read, have you read the whole trilogy?
Boy, look at the time. No, I have not. I read the first two books with the full intention of reading the trilogy probably about 20 years ago, 18 or 20 years ago. And then I don't know if I just didn't have it. I think I was borrowing them from you or something, but I never got to the third one. And by the way, they're called, like, volume one is called, I think it's The Wreath, you know, having to do with the wedding.
Yeah, that's right.
And volume two, I can't remember, but volume three is The Cross, which gives you a flavor of, you know, an idea of the flavor of that book. What is volume two called?
Volume two is The Wife. So it's like the first volume is kind of all okay. About her betrothal and then the broken betrothal and getting married. Volume two is basically about her domestic life with her husband. It also kind of broadens out into sort of like Norwegian politics and their interactions with other neighboring countries, which is pretty interesting. I mean, the amount of research that went into this trilogy is absolutely staggering. The details and the writing about the physical surroundings of Norway, it's just, the whole thing's a stunning achievement. And then volume three, as you said, is called The Cross. And at some point she loses her husband. And, you know, I guess it's not too much of a spoiler to say she decides to, like in Mariette of Ecstasy, or Mariette, I'm forgetting the title all of a sudden.
In Ecstasy.
Mariette in Ecstasy. She decides to dedicate the rest of her life to God. So she enters the convent after having had this incredibly, you know, eventful and complex family life. But anyway, you know, I could go on forever about it. You know, a lot of, you're not alone. Plenty of people haven't read it. It's just, and I should say that I read it for the first time about 20 years ago, and I've recently been reading through it again. So I've been through the first volume, the second volume, and I plan on finishing out with the third volume. Just an incredible character, but we got to move on.
I mean, you just, that is an amazing character. It's a great choice. I mean, I fear that people are going to be like, oh, here's these two white Catholic guys, you know, with two characters that became nuns. You know, I mean, it's going to change up a little bit, but that is an amazing series. Like, I remember really being impressed the first two volumes. I definitely should, and I probably will go back and read, you know, the third one and all three of them again. And I would just say, like, you know, the character's amazing. You know, there's a reason why she's kind of like the titular character and like the anchor of the entire series, because it's an incredible invention. And also just like those books, you're right, like they're like that series of books, just for anybody listening who might be interested to try them. It's like, you know, even the first two volumes, some of the best historical novels or novels in general that I've read that had to do with A, consequences of your choices in life. You know, you talked about it being like a timeless series of books. You know, it's one of the best, you know, inventions, fictional portrayals of how life and your life choices have consequences. And the second is just about marriage. You know, it's one of the best portraits of marriage. And you talk about, you know, thick and thin, or for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse. This series like lays that stuff out in a flesh and blood in a way few other fictional portrayals of marriage have ever done.
Absolutely. You know? And it's not just that, there are other relationships that are delved into as well that are just as interesting. So, but we're both going to have to do a better job of like being a little tighter with these descriptions, because we're never going to get through this list. And I blame myself first, but why don't we keep going?
Yeah. Okay. Well, like I said, I only have four, and then I'll throw some out at the end. But, all right. So we reached the part of the episode, John, and I was not looking forward to this, where I have to issue my mea culpa. You know, I am, and that's to you. I said I wasn't going to do this. But when I reviewed this, I had to. My next character is Elizabeth Bennet from Pride and Prejudice. You know, well, it happens to be written by a woman everybody knows called Jane Austen. John, I'll try to do this quickly. I thought, you know, because, you know, as we've discussed many times on the podcast, John has no time for Jane Austen or any book that has to do with, you know, manners or, you know, like, you know, these romances from the 19th century, you know, will they marry, will they not marry? And all of John's criticisms that have been outlined in other episodes of this show, I think have a lot of validity. Like, I wouldn't argue with him too much, you know. Definitely don't appeal to a lot of men that I know, you know, Pride and Prejudice and Jane Austen books. Well, listen, John, the reason why I'm talking about Elizabeth Bennet, I was thinking about this and I was like, well, first of all, she's definitely one of the most memorable female characters that I've ever read. You know, so I had just on memorability, I had to choose her.
But I mean, that's interesting right there because I read the book. I don't remember anything about her.
Yeah, you forgot it immediately. Yeah. I don't know. I was thinking about this.
Minority, for sure.
I was really thinking about this and I thought, you know, why is a, you know, because I'm kind of fascinated by my own response to Jane Austen. You know, the fact that I really like those books. And because I normally could care less about the manners and, you know, will they or won't they get married and the dances and let's take a turn around the room and all that stuff, hoity-toity stuff that comes with these books. But I think, you know, Elizabeth Bennet in Pride and Prejudice is so memorable to me because she has, I think it comes down to the word dignity, you know, and if I were a woman, you know, and I tried to put myself in the kind of circumstances that a woman in a Jane Austen novel is in, who happens to have my own thoughts and opinions and I wanted to kind of, you know, assert them and stand on my own two feet, my options would be so limited, you know, and my prospects would be so limited in doing that. Would I have kind of the strength or the sense of self to kind of put my foot down and say, no, I'm not marrying, you know, Mr. Collins, the preacher, because I would like to marry somebody that I'm falling in love with, a little bit like in Kristen Lavin's Daughter. So it has this like timeless quality. And I just think that, you know, in Pride and Prejudice, Elizabeth Bennet refuses to marry people she's kind of lined up with in these arranged situations because she would rather marry somebody that she's fallen in love with. And then eventually she does in the book and ends up marrying that person after having a lot of conflict with that person. But she does it in the face of all the social expectations of her. She does it, you know, she has such a clear sense of herself that she just knows that she's going to, you know, do the right thing because she has confidence in herself and in her choices. And I think in a way that, you know, the world that she lives in makes her seem like a fool or ridiculous, you know. And if I were a young woman looking at a character like that, you know, I would find that character very somebody to kind of aspire towards. You know, and I think it would, you know, the brilliant way that Jane Austen kind of presented this young woman as kind of like asserting herself in this kind of situation, to me is very admirable and very memorable. And furthermore, she's one of the most realistic female characters that I think I've ever read. She has these like sisters, these four sisters, and they're all different and they all come over as kind of ridiculous to her at different times. And they all think she's ridiculous. And that's like an extremely accurate that I can see portrayal of like a bunch of sisters living in one family. And then there's this whole fraught relationship with her mother, where her mother is like desperate to hook her up with somebody who's like gonna have, you know, wealth and give her like solid prospects. And, you know, they totally butt heads. And if you've never met a, you know, a daughter and a mother that butt heads before, then you're not living on planet Earth, you know. And I thought that was one of the most realistic portraits I've ever seen, just by my own observations of like when mothers and daughters clash, you know. And in the end, I just kind of admire her spine, you know, which she has, and she manages to kind of maintain that spine without being like, you know, forgive me, like bitchy or overbearing or whatever. She just kind of knows herself and sticks with it. And for that reason, I think she's one of the most memorable characters. And I kind of, you know, have like a soft spot for her because I think she, you know, is convincing. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, that's a solid case. And it also, you know, touches on why a lot of people view think that she's a character that is a good role model for young women. I mean, including my own wife, who tried to get my daughter to read Jane to read it. And she struggled with it, so she hasn't read it yet. But someday she probably will, and I think that has a lot to do with it. But I don't remember a ton about that book because I, as you know, I just could not
get blotted it out.
I could not get into it. However, but I do think I remember enough to kind of realize what you're saying. I do remember she was a more believable, kind of relatable character than any of the ridiculous sisters. And, you know, certainly the complexity of female relationships across generations or even in the same generation comes through loud and clear in that book. But that was undoubtedly part of Jane Austen's life as well. So, and that is a major part of life on this planet, you know. You know, a lot of women have complicated relationships with sisters and mothers. Just like, I mean, it's the same. You know, the father-son bond is complicated in a different way, you know. But, yeah, I think I didn't retain a lot of that book. I can't really comment on it that much, but I think you make a convincing case. And certainly, without question, you know, she's one of the most famous female characters in the Western literary tradition anyway, and for a good reason, you know. And also, one thing you can't miss from Jane Austen when you read her, and it comes through in this character in particular, is just the intelligence, you know?
Right.
I mean, yeah. She's just a very, very intelligent woman, the writer Jane Austen, and she imbues some of that intelligence in the character of Elizabeth Bennet. So, yeah, you know, it would be pretty surprising to have this list and not have Jane Austen come up at some point, you know?
Yeah, well, not from your side, but yeah, you know, I just couldn't keep her off the list, so yeah, I didn't.
I mean, but, you know, we joke about it a lot, but, you know, these books are read and reread and reread yet again for a reason, so.
Yep.
My next character takes us, you know, into the present day, and is totally different, you know, than my first choice. Well, I read this book a couple years ago. I know that you will remember me having read it and having had a really positive reaction to it. But the book and the character has just quite simply stayed with me ever since I read it. So it was a book that came out, I want to say 3 to 4 years ago, written by, I believe I should have done my homework, but I believe a Ghanaian American writer named Yah Jesse. She wrote a book called Homegoing, I think. I don't think it's called Homecoming. I think it's called Homegoing. I might be wrong about that. That was her first novel, you know, back maybe about 5 years ago. This was her second novel and follow-up to that, and it's a novel called Transcendent Kingdom. And the main character is a woman named Gifty, which I think may be a nickname. But she lives with her family in the deep south of Alabama, but they are Ghanaian immigrants. That right there is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's a sort of the story of where she is in her life as a young woman. She has a brother who is a very good athlete and basketball player and super charismatic older brother who meant the world to her. And he was sort of like the apple of her parents' eyes. Even though her mother, I think her father stayed in Africa and she's growing up with her mother and brother way down in Alabama. Her brother gets involved with the wrong people. He gets into drugs. He overdoses on drugs and unfortunately dies. And this has a shattering effect on the family. Her mother falls into a deep depression. Gifty, sort of like as is sort of telegraphed by her name, is an extremely intelligent and gifted student. She, because of her life circumstances and because of what happened with her brother and her mother, she gets interested in brain science and neurology. So she's a graduate student who's studying, is basically kind of like made her life choices because of things that have happened in her life. So she's studying basically depression within laboratory rats, and also the impact of drugs on those same rats. She's trying to understand how the brain reacts to these certain stresses. What I didn't mention, but is a huge part of the novel, is that her parents are Christians. They get involved with I can't remember what denomination, but an evangelical church that is a huge part of their life in Alabama. So she grew up in the church. So it's a book that very much deals with the confluence or the crossroads of science and faith. So this character, Gifty, is not only trying to figure out just sort of the mysteries and the sorrows of her own life through it, she pours herself into brain science as a way to try to understand what happened to her brother with his addictions and what is happening with her mother and her extreme depression. At the same time, she's trying to reconcile her interest and passion for science with her Christian faith and her Christian upbringing. So you have a book that's really just jam-packed with potent and moving questions, of human suffering, of loss and sorrow, of familial relations, of, is science right? Is theology right? How do we understand our place in the world? All this stuff is running together. And what I love about the character of Gifty is just her earnestness. She is genuinely trying to seek out answers and solutions to her deep sorrows and dilemmas in her life. And that's what the book is. It's this fascinating mix of both science and religion or theology or whatever you want to call it. And how these questions, they're not just questions up in the sky. They're questions that profoundly impact her life and how she can keep going and living her life and find happiness. Is the answer in science? Is the answer in religion? Is there a way to reconcile the two? That's what this book is about. And, it's right there in the title, Transcending Kingdom. I thought this was a beautifully written book, a book with a ton of potent questions in it. And the character of Gifty, she's just so genuine and tormented. And I felt like you were really getting kind of a view into the mind of someone who is extremely gifted, but, has dealt with a ton of challenges in her life, and there are no easy answers to any of them. Add into this all that she's also, an immigrant from Ghana who's trying to, live in Alabama and then later Southern California. And she has some struggles there in terms of assimilating. It's just it's a fascinating book that's full of important questions. And I thought it engaged the mind in a very powerful way, but also the heart in a way that a lot of books don't. So that's why the book and the character have stood out to me. And I have not forgotten it since I read it. So I've recommended it to you before. I still do. I recommend it to anybody who's listening to this, Transcendent Kingdom by Yah Jesse.
Well, why don't we take a quick break, because I'm afraid that the app is going to cut us off, but then I'll react to that briefly and just move on to my next one.
That sounds good to me.
All right, quick break, and then we'll come back.
Okay.
All right, so we're back from our break, and John, you were discussing briefly. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay. The character of Gifty from the novel Transcendent Kingdom, if I have that right?
That's right.
Is it Jesse?
Jesse, I think, is how you say it.
Jesse. Fascinating character. I remember you reading that book, what is it, like a year or two ago?
Yeah, I think it was on my top 10 list last year. I know it was.
Okay. And you were really taken by it,
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that character was going to come back in this discussion. So it was interesting to hear your outline of the character in the book. And, you know, I'll say that it sounds like a book that's sort of right down your alley with, you know, questions of sort of science and faith and like kind of the intersection between those things. But, you know, really like it's a, it would be down a lot of people's alley who are interested in some of those, you know, some of the way those things converge in our reality, you know, and anybody who has an interest in kind of like solving some of those issues that seem to conflict would probably enjoy a book like this. But that does seem like a very rich female character with like appealing qualities who's trying to like, you know, grasp whatever has come her way in life, you know, through both of these means that she's been exposed to, both in the science and academic circles as well as the faith circles that she came up in. So there's a lot going on with her, but it seems like a really you can see why that character is so memorable, you know?
Yeah, and I'd be remiss to say, June, you know, probably know where I'm going with this, but as the two of the sons of a man who was both a brain scientist and a former priest, or at least priest in training, it was really hard to read Transcendent Kingdom and not think of, you know, our old man and how he, I don't know what he would have thought of the novel, but I know that he would have appreciated a lot of the questions that come up in the novel for different reasons, you know? So like, it was impossible to read this and not think of him a little bit or have him kind of hanging around in the background of my mind. So that's an added element for us, but you got to read the book at some point, I think, but you know.
Yeah. Well, I'd be really interested to do that. So, well, I'm going to shift to another contemporary character also, leap forward. Well, Mariette was contemporary, but the next character I'm going to talk about is, you know, falls firmly into the category of a character that's really memorable to me. And the character's name is Serena Pemberton. And she is featured in two books by the North Carolina writer that I've mentioned several times, even recently, by the name of Ron Rash, who I think is one of the great American fiction writers, period, male or female, you know, who's living and writing today. He is a writer of both novels and short stories. And most of his work is set in like Appalachia or the American South, like North Carolina, Western Carolina, you know, West Virginia, like those regions of the country. And he created a character in a novel that came out in 2008 called Serena. So it's like Kristen Lama's daughter, like the titular character. And that novel is about a guy who's like a young man just starting out, and he's like a lumber baron. And he's just kind of like emerging as like a big force in like the lumber world in Appalachia in the early part of the 20th century, like the 20s and 30s. He owns all this property and they're cutting down all the, you know, this is before we depleted all the trees. And before all the national parks came into play, or around the time that the national parks were coming into play, and he owns all this land, he's cutting down all the trees and he's making a mint. And he goes to this like conference of loggers or something. I'm trying to remember all the details. And he meets this beautiful young woman out of nowhere who kind of sweeps in and, you know, takes over his entire life to his doom. Because this character, Serena, who becomes Serena Pemberton, the man's name is Pemberton, she kind of sweeps him off his feet, you know, sort of bowls him over. They end up getting falling in love rapidly, getting married, you know, and, you know, you could very easily make the argument that she spots him and just kind of targets him because she's a power-hungry, you know, character. And it's the beginning of this saga that centers around this young woman who comes into this lumber world that's like a man's world in the earliest part of the 20th century. And by virtue of getting under this young man's skin and becoming kind of joined at the hip with him, she takes over the entire operation and turns into this like lumber baroness, you know. And she's a fascinating character because she's basically Lady Macbeth, John. She's like hungry for power and lusting for power, lusting for prestige, lusting for respect. And she'll do anything to get it. And the way that she does it, because she lives in this like, you know, man's world, is to show her own strength at the most appropriate times, but also just sort of wield her power over this man, basically in the bedroom or, you know, like in intimate settings, and, you know, kind of direct him to do what she wants him to do, you know. And as, you know, people begin to – grow weary of her and threats come in from all directions in the novel Serena, she basically turns to getting her husband to like basically kill off their enemies, you know, and you know, by those means, they achieve the highest heights of power over this like kind of lumber world. But then there are tragic consequences, including, you know, spoiler alert, I guess, but including for the guy that marries her, you know, and then she, you know, the further this novel Serena goes on, it's written in like a very poetic but like really powerful way. The darker and darker this character Serena becomes, and you find out little bits and pieces about her, which is that she basically came from nothing and she experienced a whole lifetime's worth of abuse before she was even a very young woman. And she just turns into this character who's absolutely determined to not let anybody direct her way through the world or stop her from getting anything that she wants to get. And it ends up being this very fascinating psychological portrayal of somebody who's just been wrong so many times and been numbed over by so many men, frankly, and just powerful people in the world that she just rebels and turns herself into somebody who will take back that power by force and by any means that are available to her, you know? So, and then the Ron Rash also wrote, I mentioned in a couple podcasts ago, there was a collection of stories that I read recently that I really loved by Ron Rash. And one of them was a novella that was like a sequel to the novel Serena. And it talks about, you know, I hate to say like a spoiler, but at the end of the novel Serena, she basically kills her husband by convincing him to go out into the woods on this hunt for a panther where she knows he's going to be vulnerable to one of the biggest problems in the lumber world is rattlesnakes and the you know, the what's the word that I want, the plenitude, or you know, the multi, I can't think of the word I want, but the large amount of rattlesnakes that are in this area that they're trying to harvest the trees in, and that's like a major, yes, proliferation, yes, and like a, you know, a major threat to the men. And she puts him in a position where he can get attacked by a rattlesnake, and he does, and she basically leaves him there to die in the woods, you know, because his weaknesses are starting to emerge and he becomes another threat or another vulnerability in her grand scheme. And then there's a sequel novella called In the Valley, where she comes back to the area after having escaped to Brazil for 20 years, basically escaping from the authorities who are closing in on her at the end of Serena. Wow. She comes back after 20 years, and then she takes over the operation again and is charged with clearing out a whole valley of trees, like within like a 72-hour period. And she does that in that story. And she, you know, uses increasingly brutal means to like dominate all the men that are working under her. So she's just kind of like, you know, the fact that she, just to wrap it up, the fact that she's like a convincing kind of modern version of Lady Macbeth, set in this real patriarchal society, who manages to become darker and darker and succeed in all of her plans, but with great tragic consequences, and that you can never really penetrate how evil basically this woman is because of all that's been forced on her in the early part of her life. She was like, to me, one of the darkest, darkest, darkest characters I've ever come across, the most sinister and the most deplorable, but really one of the most memorable. So that's my next one.
Yeah, that's interesting, because one of my sort of honorable mention characters, I'm hearing a little bit of an echo here, so I apologize if listeners are too. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. I never hear it.
One of my honorable mention characters was going to be Lady Macbeth, just because she's such an iconic character in the history of literature.
Right.
I just weirdly happened to watch one of the film adaptations of Macbeth last night with a couple of my kids. So she's kind of fresh in the mind. But yes, this character of Serena really seems like, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche to like, when there's any kind of like sort of dominant or what's the word I'm looking for? Like manipulative woman who's married to a man, you sort of call them Lady Macbeth, or a Lady Macbeth figure. But in this case, I mean, she just sounds like a genuinely, I don't use this word lightly, but like an evil character. So, you know,
yes, it's kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
She's really terrifying. Yeah.
It's interesting that we have a character like that on this list. So again, it's not, we say favorite, it's not like somebody we want to emulate, but just someone who sticks out, you know, a character who you just don't forget. And clearly the character, right, Serena, has been one of those characters for you. I know you didn't, she stuck out to you after reading the novel, but then you know, kind of revisited her story along with Ron Rash in that novella or long short story, which I think was In the Valley, right?
Right, In the Valley, yeah.
Yeah, so that's great. That's cool, you know, to just have somebody who's just like, just kind of a deplorable person, but certainly memorable.
That's right, yeah.
But I haven't read, you know, I've only read one book of stories by Ron Rash, so I haven't read either of the stories involving Serena, which is too bad. And then they made it into a movie, Serena, and it was had, I think Jennifer Lawrence was in it, like, you know, kind of like an A-list cast, but I don't remember it making much of a impact. Have you ever seen it?
I saw it recently, yeah, because I had read In the Valley. I wanted to see it. Yeah, and it was directed by a very accomplished female director. I can't remember her name now. She was the director of the movie In a Better World. What's the name of that woman? Oh, man. She's made many feature films.
Not sure I've seen In a Better World.
Okay, I can't remember her name. I'll have to kind of look that up, like, and maybe we'll get that intern going on it. But an accomplished female director. Kind of two A-list stars, Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, but it really flopped at the box office and with critics, and it changed the ending of the book too. Although I thought it was kind of interesting to watch because I think Jennifer Lawrence is talented enough,
yeah,
and I thought she was good in this movie. So she's very beautiful, but also I think she was talented enough to bring off kind of the essence of this character, and I thought she really did. But there were some glaring miscasts and other parts of the film, and they changed the ending, which I thought was unfortunate. So it wasn't that great of a movie, but it was a really good performance, though. And so, you know, it's probably worth seeing, but not nowhere near as good as Ron Rash's novel. And
well, Ron Rash is a guy that I definitely need to get back to. You know, you've been banging the drum for him for a long time, but just reading that one collection of stories, you know, I got it. You know, you could,
yeah. He's really good. You know, people should read him.
Yeah, the talent was on display there. Definitely not well-known or well-read enough. Well, my next character is sort of along the lines of Christian Lavrin's daughter. She's a character from a huge epic book. And like the Christian Lavrin's daughter trilogy, it's a book that means an incredible amount to me. It's one of my favorite novels. I know you haven't read it yet. We may someday dedicate an episode to this novel, although it's a challenging one, and a lot of people are going to either roll their eyes or just say, dismiss this, say, I'm never reading that book. The book I'm talking about is Middlemarch by George Eliot,
mm-hmm,
who is a female writer, in case anybody doesn't know that, even though she wrote under the pseudonym George Eliot. Middlemarch is an all-world book to me. As I said, it means a lot to me. It's I think it's one of the great novels ever written. And it's much too big to try to like really dive into this character. It's about 900 pages. And one of the main characters of the book is named Dorothea Brooke, but she marries a guy early in the book named Casaubon. And so she, for most of the book, although their marriage falls apart, she's known as Dorothea Casaubon. Later in the book, she marries somebody named Ladislaw. But she's one of the most important characters in the book. Like Kristen Lavrin's daughter, it's a huge and epic book that really is about your life choices. And in particular, in Middlemarch, it focuses on a couple different marriages and different characters in this community called Middlemarch. But Dorothea for the majority of the book, is involved in a marriage that is just not a happy one. She just does not. She sort of marries somebody kind of out of pity, which is always a terrible idea. And it's a troubled marriage, and it falls apart, as I said. But what the book is really about, and it would take a lot more time to kind of get into this, it's a very, very ambitious book that looks at what does it mean to live a meaningful and valuable life? And what makes one's life have value in terms of the rest of the world? And so that sounds really highfalutin, but it's really a book about how do I live my life in a way where I'm contributing to the society around me, and I'm making choices, and I'm doing things that are meaningful. And I think a lot of people can relate to those questions. Like, how do I have one life. How do I make it not just memorable for me, but how do I have a positive impact on the world? And that's what Middlemarch is really about. And it kind of looks at different characters and some of the choices that they've made and sort of the hash that some of them have made of their life. And in Dorothea's case is no exception. She gets married to a guy who's kind of an academic. He's sort of a mousy guy. He's working on this great magnum opus that he's going to publish eventually one day. And he spends about 20 years trying to write this thing. It never gets finished. She's very supportive of him. She hangs in there to the very end. But the guy is just a failure. And so she ends up, my memory's terrible, so I'll admit I can't remember whether he actually passes away or they split up, but she ends up getting married to another man later in her life. But she basically has to pick up the pieces of her life and, look at the choices she's made, look at kind of the ways that she's wasted some of the years of her life and say, what am I going to do now in order to have a positive impact on the world? I want to do good in the world. How do I do that? And there are a lot of characters in the book that are kind of grappling with these questions in different ways. And Eliot is enough of a writer to kind of give us a variety of compelling characters, but also kind of write them this sort of higher level and write a very moral book without being preachy and just focusing on different questions that all of us can relate to if we take our lives seriously. I love the book Middlemarch. It's a long book. I think it's beautifully written. It takes some effort and some persistence to get through it, but I think it's absolutely rich in wisdom and has just a lot to say about what makes life meaningful. And it really gets you thinking about those questions. So Dorothea Brooke, the reason I love her is that she's in a very disappointing situation. She tries to do the right thing in almost every situation. It doesn't work out for her. And then she has to pick up the pieces of her life and she can just whine about it or complain. Or she could say, what am I going to do now? How am I going to use the rest of my time to try to do something positive in the world? And I love the character because of that. In the end, she sort of quietly triumphs, not in any big way, but she refuses to quit and she hangs on to her ideals. And we follow this character right up to the very, very end of the book, where I remember memorably George Eliot says something like, she was buried in one of these nameless graves, like without a lot of fanfare, but her life had a lot of value anyway in terms of the people that she impacted, something like that. So I really love this book. It's far too vast to try to really make a comprehensive case for it. But the character of Dorothea, just the way that she navigates her life through many ups and downs, and yet persists and stick to her ideals, I really admire. So she's always stayed with me. I can't wait to read that book again. And, it's an older book. It's British. It has some of the same characteristics, Jude, of maybe Jane Austen's novels. in terms of the way they're written and kind of like, you know, the morality and whatnot. But someday I'm going to be really interested to see if the book has anywhere near the impact on you that it had on me. But anyway, impossible to do this list without mentioning Dorothea from Middlemarch.
Well, it's kind of amazing that anybody from any era, you still hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Wrote a book that's like 900 pages that you consider one of your favorites. If anybody knows John, like he doesn't do like 900 page books much, or he does, but he doesn't always, you know, enjoy them as much as, or find them as memorable as he does with Middlemarch. Yeah. And I've been hearing you trump up Middlemarch for years. You know, I have a copy right in my basement that I've been circling around for many years because of how much you've talked about it. But I've still never read it. I'm definitely going to. That is one that I'm definitely going to read. But and you're probably like, dude, you keep saying that, and it never quite happens. But, you know.
I believe it'll happen.
Yeah, it'll happen. You know, I'm no stranger to 900-page books from the 19th century. You know.
Hell, you're about to read one.
Yeah, that's right. We'll get to that later, maybe. But yeah, like that, you know, that book made a major impression on you, John, and like you've been talking about it for years. And the main character is that woman, as far as I know. Dorothea, is that her name? Yeah. I have that right?
She's one of them. She's one of the main characters.
Yeah, I guess there's a number of different characters. But, you know, anyway, I mean, yeah, you just did a really good job of explaining why. And, you know, I still find it incredible that that book has raked so highly with you because of how long it is. But when you were, the whole time you were reading it, you were like, you know, I love this book, you know. So obviously George Eliot did something that you admired with her long story there, but that character, you know, it's easy to understand why it's so memorable, because it's just somebody who kind of like perseveres, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I'm going to go in a very different direction, and this is not going to be as appreciated by you personally, John, because this just isn't really your wheelhouse so far. But I had to include this character on my list because of how memorable she is and like how much I've kind of been enjoying her story. So, this is kind of a curveball from the rest of my list. But then I realized as I was trying to identify characters, female characters that really did stick with me for a number of years. I haven't been reading about this one for too long. This one kind of rose to the top. I said, I've got to mention her, you know, but you're not very familiar with her, John. The name of the character is Daenerys Targaryen, and she's from the series of novels popularly known as Game of Thrones, written by George R.R. Martin. You know, which began famously with a book called A Game of Thrones, and it's now gone for 5 novels, and he's been working on the 6th novel for about 12 years or something like that, and there's going to be a 7th novel also if he lives that long. You know, it's this huge fantasy series. Everybody knows what Game of Thrones is because it was made so popular by the HBO series of the same name, which went farther than the novels did controversially. And ended in what, you know, most people, fans of the book series, considered a train wreck. You know, I never made it. I did see 4 or 5 seasons of Game of Thrones, the series, but I never made it to the end. And I've actually only read 4 of the 7 novels. 5 are in print now. I have the 5th one, but I haven't read it yet. I really want to read it. And then there's 6, which he's been working on forever, and then 7 is supposed to follow. So Daenerys Targaryen is one of the major characters, and it's like kind of like Middlemarch, John. It's way too big to explain. We've talked about it on this podcast before about the series. You know, it's this huge fantasy series set on this like island nation similar to England called Westeros. And, you know, there are basically these, it's set over many generations with hundreds and hundreds of characters with all dragons and swords and horses and all that stuff. It's a tremendously enjoyable series, you know, filled with sex and violence, if you want me to be frank. But I think it's an epic, epic work of the imagination. One of the most incredible feats of the imagination, or feats of creativity in the history of novels, you know. So it's this epic fantasy series that you may, if you don't like fantasy, you're not going to like. And Daenerys Targaryen is basically one of the characters. There's like three or four big families in this island nation of Westeros that basically have this large, quote, Game of Thrones. They're vying for what's called the throne of the Seven Kingdoms. And they're vying for, like, you know, being the supreme king all over these Seven Kingdoms. Daenerys Targaryen is a member of one of those families who begins in a relatively humble spot at the beginning of the series. She's the brother of the guy that's the heir to the king of his particular, you know, area of the Seven Kingdoms. And when he ascends to the throne of that part of the Seven Kingdoms, he will be in position to try to angle himself for the Iron Throne, who would rule over all the Seven Kingdoms. So she's the younger sister of this guy who might be who's heir to the throne of one of the kingdoms. It's a little bit complicated. And basically, early on in the series, her brother, who is kind of feckless, gets killed, and she gets put into this position of next in line for the throne, but because she's female, she can't ascend to the throne. So they decide to marry her off to this tribe that lives over the water in a neighboring nation that's called the Dothraki. But she's that tribe is very violent and wild and half-tamed, and they decide in kind of a political maneuver to marry her to the guy who's heir to the throne of the Dothraki. So she marries this Dothraki guy. She starts as just kind of like this handmaiden, this timid handmaiden. She's married to this guy who's the heir of this wild tribe of basically hunters and killers. They're a little bit like the Mongolians of ancient times in like China. You know, they're wild. And she, towards the end of the first book, she ingratiates herself with this guy and like learns how to be his wife. Is very subservient to him, but she's gifted these three dragon's eggs early on in the story. And eventually her husband is wounded in battle, and the wound ends up festering and he's killed. And at the end of the first book, she's mourning him and puts him onto this funeral pyre. And for some reason, she's been having like these visions and it's been imbued with these like unearthly gifts. And at the very end of the book, she walks into the fire, his funeral pyre, with these three dragon's eggs. And she emerges from the dragons, from the fire with the dragon's eggs hatched. And she has these three baby dragons on her. And that's kind of the end of the first book. And from that point forward, she becomes basically the leader of that whole wild tribe of Dothraki. And then she maneuvers throughout the rest of the series to try to ascend to this Iron Throne herself. So that's like kind of like a background of this character. But the reason why she's so memorable is because she, you know, starts off in this very lowly position, is kind of visited upon with these visions and inherits these powers, and then becomes kind of the mother of these three dragons. And her character takes this tremendous ascent to like a to political and military dominance over the entire Seven Kingdoms. And she becomes further and further corrupted by that power and ascends to a very high place in the politics of the story, but takes a tremendous character arc into this like corrupted, dominant, super powerful, strong threat to take over the entire Seven Kingdoms. So I'll kind of leave it at that, but like she's like, it's such a fascinating character arc, and it's so interesting the way she like, you know, becomes kind of almost like this mystical figure as the saga goes on, that I just think she's like definitely the most memorable fantasy character that I can remember hearing about. And since she's a woman and it's so unlikely for her to make this rise, that she becomes one of the most interesting female characters that I've ever, you know, come across as well. So
you're saying that she's one of the most interesting fantasy characters that you've ever come across of either gender?
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's wild. I've come to this point in my life and I still know basically nothing about that entire saga, because
yeah,
I've never read any of the books, nor have I seen a single frame of the TV, of the famous TV series that went on.
Right.
I don't know how many seasons. So
not really your thing.
Well, I mean, I'm sure I would get into it. But I just have never, I mean, at this point, it's so like you were saying about like huge books. I mean, it's like every one of the books is like at least 1,000 pages. It's just like, it just seems like such a commitment at this point. It's like the rest of my life is just too short.
Right. Right.
I don't know.
It's pure escapism. It's pure fantasy, you know, and you're either going to like go with that or not, but you know, she's one of like hundreds of characters though. And there are many, many memorable and strong female characters in the saga, but she stands above because of her insane arc in the story.
Well, I think, didn't we in one of our episodes, it might have been trilogies or something, like you made this whole case for why the books are worth reading. And I remember, you know, finding that pretty compelling. So, you know, I don't remember which episode that was, but, or maybe
I don't either.
Maybe it was just some, you know, you and I going back and forth on our own. But every time you talk about it, I'm sort of reminded, like, it does seem more complex and nuanced and layered than, like, I really give it credit for, which I'm sure it is because, you know, I've heard the
way. It's unbelievable. The scale of that series is unbelievable.
Yeah. It's cool to get a character like that on this list, you know?
I thought it would be different. But we can move on.
Well, we have a lot of different characters. That's one cool thing about this list. And if I may say so, this show, you know, you're going to get,
right.
You're just going to get an incredible variety. My next character is nothing like what you just described, but is one of the most memorable characters, female characters I've ever read. Now, Jude, so taking a hard hairpin, like right or left turn, take your pick. I have a 15-year-old daughter, as you know. You yourself have – I only have one daughter. You're a dad. You're a girl dad times two, and your daughters are older, a little bit older.
Right. That's right.
So, but, you know, I'm living with and raising and greatly enjoying having a 15-year-old daughter. My next character is a year younger than my daughter, Susanna, and yet – what she did was nothing less than she decided in the 1870s to basically get on a horse by herself and track down through the Texas hinterlands the man that murdered her father. And if people wanted to help her, fine, but she was going to do it either way. She's going to track down the man who murdered her dad and find him and take revenge. And of course I'm talking about Mattie Ross, who's a character in a great novel that has been made into a movie twice called True Grit. I think most people know the movie, either the John Wayne version or the more recent Coen Brothers version. I've seen the Coen Brothers version, but I've also read the book, the original novel by a man named Charles Portis. And the novel's great, and that's where you really get the voice of this young girl, Mattie Ross, who is just the reason why she's so memorable is, you know, the name of the novel is True Grit, and it comes from a line that she says she's trying to find somebody to be her guide and help her to track down this man that brutally murdered her father. She knows she's so One of the great aspects of this character is her realism. She is determined to get this man, but she knows she's a 14-year-old girl, not going to be able to do it on her own. She's trying to hire somebody to help her. And she meets this kind of grizzled lawman named Rooster Cogburn, one of the great monikers in all of literature. And he's like sort of a, you know, he's sort of a legendary, you know, killer, but he's also kind of a drunk and a curmudgeon. And she finds him and she says, and you know, the book is just, her voice is inimitable and it's full of all these incredible lines. You know, if you want just a memorable, if you want to experience a memorable female voice, you know, I would almost, I can't think of a book I would recommend higher than True Grit, because this 14-year-old girl, just the way she's written and the things that she says are just so, they just kind of leave you kind of like laughing and shaking your head. Like, I can't believe she just said that. So she's trying to get this older guy, Rooster Cogburn, to help her. And he's like hemming and hawing and he's kind of a drunk. And she goes, you know, here's the money. I aim to get Tom Chaney, who's the guy who killed her dad. And if you're not game, I will find somebody who is game. I know that you can drink whiskey, and I've seen you kill a gray rat. All the rest has been talk. They told me that you had True Grit, and that is why I came to you. I am not paying for talk. And this is a 14-year-old girl, you know. So that's where you get the title, True Grit. But really, it's such a genius title because the character, by far, who has the most true grit is Maddie Ross. And you follow her as she, you know, eventually works with this older gentleman, Rooster Cogburn. But they have they have all kinds of ups and downs. And there's another younger lawman who's, you know, a Texas Ranger in quotes, because he's, you know, most of the men in this novel are sort of like buffoonish. But the Texas Ranger does genuinely want to help her. She's got these sort of sidekicks along the way, but she is driving the train the whole time. And it's not just, you know, these days you got, you know, these Avenger, you know, those Marvel movies and, you know, movies that just try to give you a female character who just kicks the crap out of everybody and takes revenge on everybody just to sort of say, you know, girl power. Maddie Ross isn't like that at all. Charles Portis takes the time to, so that you understand, she had a very close relationship with her dad. She's crushed that she lost him. And she just wants justice. And she will stop at nothing to get it. Even though she physically does not have everything she needs in order to enact this justice and this act of
anger. Anything she needs.
Anything she needs. Like, she could barely ride a horse by herself.
Right.
But she just will not stop. And you can tell, it's not like the Terminator, where it's programmed into her. It's motivated by her love for her dad and her just hunger and thirst for justice.
But although she might take down the Terminator if she was like that.
And you know. And by the way, the whole novel is told in retrospect. So she's an older lady. And she's looking back on her life, and she never married, and she talks about that. She just doesn't apologize for anything that she's ever done. But she just describes this whole episode in detail, and she pays a very steep price in the end, for taking this journey of sort of revenge. And, you know, she loses an arm. She never gets it back. You know, she has a very sort of difficult life, but she's unapologetic in, you know, looking back at what happened. And she's just one of the most memorable voices in literature. I just love the way she's written. Charles Portis is somebody who's like Ron Rash, not read widely enough, but you know, the old acronym you hear the kids use these days. If you know, you know. You know, if you know about Charles Portis, you know. And I've rarely read a more memorable character than Maddie Ross, and she's just stayed with me, and she probably always will. So.
That's a great one.
She demanded a place on this list.
Forced her way in.
That's right. She wasn't going to take no for an answer in the story or in being a part of this episode, Jude. There's nothing I can do.
Well, you know, you're like most of the guys in that movie. They get, you know, they come up against her and they go down, you know?
Yeah, she doesn't, and what's great about it is that she suffers. She does not get through this story lightly or without consequence, but she just refuses to give up. She's the one with the true grit.
Yeah, 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 that's a great title. And, you know, I've always heard that it's a great book. I've never read it, but I, you know, someday I will, for sure.
You got it. You would absolutely love it. It's like, as great as the movie is, you just don't get the same voice as you do through Charles Portis's writing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, do you have one more, or did we get to the end of your list?
We got the end of my list. I have kind of like a potpourri of other sort of honorable mentions that I would literally mention, maybe not without going too long into it.
Why don't we check? Sorry to cut you off. I had one more that I was going to talk about in a little bit of detail. But I think at this point, just looking at the clock, why don't we just kind of have a speed round? We could each kind of just mention who, if we had more time, we would add to this list and talk about.
Okay.
Yeah, if you have a list of some other characters that you want to mention, go ahead.
Okay, well, all right. So the first one I had on my list, and these were ones that I thought I might talk about longer, but just decided not to. One of my favorite books of all time is The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck, and one of the most memorable characters in that book is Ma Jode, the head of the Jode family.
Hey, man, I got to interrupt here because, as I think you know, my son is currently reading that book on your recommendation, and he's reading he's reading it for the first time.
Yeah, I wonder how that's going to go, because I sometimes wonder, you know, that The Grapes of Wrath is a life-changing book for me, and that's not hyperbolic. You know, I remember sitting, you know, I was just getting into creative writing, and I remember reading one particular paragraph, I'll never forget it, saying, like, this is, I want to be like a guy who can write on this level, you know, that book, and I could open the book and find the paragraph and read it, you know, so that's the kind of book Grapes of Wrath is for me. And, you know, everybody knows the story, you know, the Jode family, you know, migrating from the Midwest to the coast, trying to find work and survive the Great Depression. And Ma Jode is the matriarch of that family, who raises Tom Jode, the main character. And they have, you know, that famous exchange where she's like, how am I going to find you, towards the end of the book? And he explains that she can find him wherever somebody's being beat up, you know, like the, you know, and then famously, like, you know, the movie ends, the book ends in a way that's very famous, and we've discussed it before, I think, you know, and it had kind of like a controversial ending. But when they made the Hollywood version, which is also justifiably famous, John Ford's film, The Grapes of Wrath, ends with a monologue from Ma Jode in a car talking about the people, like the spirit of the people. Yeah. It wasn't really true to the novel, but it's kind of become part of the character of Ma Jode. But anyway, Ma Jode from The Grapes of Wrath, like, you know, she made my short long list.
Are you going to mention the rest of yours and do them all at once?
Oh, do you want me to do that? Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah,
you
know, because
another one is another titular character named Maggie Cassidy. One of my favorite books when I was a young man was written by Jack Kerouac, and it's an obscure book of his called Maggie Cassidy. And it was just this sentimental book that plucked out by a single young man's heartstrings, I guess. But I've always had a really soft spot for the novel Maggie Cassidy, which I think I've read two or three times. And Maggie Cassidy is just a teenage girl, basically, that the main character in this sort of first romance novel falls for. You know, the young man who's telling the story in the novel, Maggie Cassidy, she's just this young woman in a New England town that he's kind of like infatuated with. And she's kind of this like flighty sort of 50s style, kind of like the girl in Back to the Future, the mother in Back to the Future, you know, like, but she's just a memorable character for me. She's like, you know, because the character, the main character in the book has the name of Jean, because he's like French Canadian, J-E-A-N, and he's kind of just gaga for Maggie. And Maggie Cassidy always stuck in my head. She's one of my favorite characters, I would have to say. Another one I almost mentioned, John, but that she's just kind of a side character, so I thought it was like not really enough, but she's certainly memorable, is Sabbath Lily Hawkes from the novel Wise Blood by Flannery O'Connor. She's like the daughter of the fake preacher who kind of comes up against Hazel Motes in the novel Wise Blood by Flannery O'Connor, and she's kind of just a weird character. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. She's kind of like a weird character who kind of goes toe-to-toe with Hazel Motes, who's trying to establish his own Church of Christ without Christ in Wise Blood. And she has a lot of funny lines, and she's just weird. But she kind of fades out of the novel two-thirds of the way through. But that's kind of one of my more memorable characters. Two more. Lady Jessica from the Dune saga, who at the beginning of the novel Dune is the mother of Paul Atreides, who becomes the guy who, like, is the sort of the godhead of the whole Dune universe. She's like kind of this in this interesting position because she's the mother of this guy who's like prophesized to be sort of like a messiah over the whole universe of the Dune world. But she's also a member of this bizarre, like basically sisterhood of witches called the Bene Gesserit. If anybody's seen like the Dune movies or read some of the Dune books, and she has loyalty to that group. And there's a very imperious and very powerful mother, reverend mother figure in that group who's kind of pulling on her strings in one direction. But she basically makes this faithful choice to advocate for her son over the witch sisterhood that she's a part of, with very long and dire consequences for her. So she's a fascinating character from the world of science fiction. Lady Jessica, I really like that character. And lastly, I recently have been talking about the Irish writer Claire Keegan, who wrote a gorgeous novel called Small Things Like These. And then she has another very short novella called Foster, about a young girl who's taken in by foster parents in rural Ireland and slowly ingratiates herself into their world and their life. It's a beautifully written character. The story Foster is told from the point of view of this like 9-year-old girl who's just trying to figure out the life that she's been supplanted and put into because her parents are too poor to take care of her for certain times of the year. And in the novel Foster, she's unnamed, but in the beautiful and highly recommended film version, which is called The Quiet Girl, she goes by the name of Cait, which is Cait, which is like a Gaelic name, and they call her Cait. But that's a beautiful character too, because she's so convincing and heartbreaking as a young 9-year-old who's trying to figure out like the world around her under very difficult circumstances. So that's it for me.
Yeah, dang. Yeah, I'm looking forward to – you gave me a copy of that book, and I'm really looking forward to reading that and also seeing the movie. Like that it's going to happen because you gave me Small Things Like These by Claire Keegan, which is a really powerful and short book. So I'm intrigued to check out more.
Yeah.
Well, if we had like double the time, there's a bunch of characters that I would also like to talk about, but we don't. You know, and I'm sure some listeners are, you know, thanking their lucky stars that we don't have double the time.
That we don't.
But there are many others that I would love to talk about. Here's just a sampling of some of them. One is from a very famous American book, and justifiably so, called Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. Mm-hmm. And the main character is a woman named Janie Crawford. And the book is basically her life story. She goes back to her hometown, links up with one of her old friends, kind of goes through her whole life story. This book is memorable for many, many reasons, not the least of which is just the determination and kind of the grit and the guts of the main character, Janie Crawford, who has gone through everything from, you know, physical and sexual abuse to, you know, slavery in her past family and the reverberations of that. She has a long marriage to somebody that's unhappy, and the guy is eventually, you know, both verbally and then physically abusive to her. She finally makes her way out of that marriage and gets involved with another man who's kind of a sort of a drifter. And one of the really interesting things about this book, have you ever read Their Eyes Were Watching God?
No, I never have. No, I've never read Houston at all.
It's a justifiably American classic. And one of the most interesting things to me is almost the entire book takes place in very rural Florida. So not like Orlando or like Disneyland. This ain't that at all. And in the climax of the book, there's a massive hurricane that hits Florida, and her second husband is actually ends up dying as a result of that. But there's a long passage in the book that describes the hurricane, and it's really riveting. So this is a book that deals with racism and, you know, the African-American experience in the United States in the rural South, but, you know, even has just sort of this like very memorable description of like horrible weather. And, you know, it's just a very, really memorable, tale of African-American lives in America, right up there with something from like Toni Morrison. I mean, she's really sort of a precursor to Toni Morrison in a way. Just yeah. A fascinating book and a fascinating character. So there's another. Okay, so just to go, I already mentioned Lady Macbeth. She would definitely be on my list. Jim Shepherd is a short story writer we've talked about. We dedicated a whole episode to. One of his more recent stories, it was called The World to Come, and it was made into a film. It involves these two, you know, for lack of a better word, like kind of frontier women who are living on in the American frontier. I think it's during the 19th century, but early, you know, kind of living on farms with their husbands. And they meet and they just, unbeknownst to them or anyone else, they just kind of fall wildly in love with each other. So at a time where that is just, you know, problematic to say the least. But what's, and so it's a, you know, it's an, it's quite an interesting story about these two women in a different time who fall in love and how that just completely upends their lives. But what I really like about it is how vividly drawn both of the women are. And, you know, they have all kinds of struggles with their husbands and their difficult lives on farms and, you know, kind of living in these very rural areas. And they're both just like really kind of memorable characters. And then the way they interact is just, you know, it's hard to explain, but they're like, you know, two wires crackling when they get together, and neither one of them can explain it or figure it out, but it completely upends and sort of changes their lives. But I thought the two characters were really vividly rendered. And, you know, it's not really not the story that I would typically be drawn to. And yet the way these characters are drawn, I found myself really being sympathetic to both of them, you know, and that's just,
yeah, that's a great story.
That's just Jim Shepherd and his incredible ability to flesh out characters. And then I have two more. There's a very famous book called The Prime of Miss Jean Brody by Muriel Spark, another criminally underrated writer. And this is her most well-known book, but it's really, it's sort of about the enduring impact of a very charismatic teacher on a group of young girls. And you come to realize her influence is maybe, it starts off being really powerful and seems like a great thing for these girls. But as the book goes along, you realize she almost becomes like a cult figure, and she's trying to sort of like impress on them her own very progressive for the time views of society. And, you know, some of it may be healthy, some of it may not be so healthy. And it's kind of a fascinating psychological examination of the impact of this one very charismatic teacher on the lives of these girls and how they go on to make decisions in their life influenced by Miss Jane Brody that may lead them down paths that aren't the right ones for them to go on, or, you know, just kind of confuse them. And so it's a really sort of vivid and interesting portrait of not just one female character, but many, and kind of the way that one who's very charismatic influences a whole group of others in numerous ways. And then finally, as a book I read this year, very recently in the last couple of months, one of the weirdest books I've read in a long time, and definitely one of the weirdest female characters you'll ever come across. It was written by a Japanese woman. And the book is a very slim novel. It's called Convenience Store Woman. And the character is named Keiko Furukura. It's basically about a woman who spends her whole adult life working in a convenience store. And everybody tells her she needs to move on and get married and move up in society. And she just can't do it because she just loves working in this convenience store. But Jude, you kind of realize midway through this very short book that it's not just that. It's a lot weirder than that. And you realize that she kind of, and I know how this is going to sound, but she sort of falls in love with the convenience store. And it's like this weird, like, becomes like something like David Lynch or David, not maybe that's the wrong David, David Cronenberg, or, you know, like she finds all of her fulfillment in the routine and in the physical surroundings of this one convenience store, and she can't leave it. And like she eventually kind of links up with a man. They don't get married, but they live together. But she sort of decides, it's like, no, this guy's an idiot. You know, I belong in the convenience store. Like, and so that's weird in itself, but it has a, you know, I don't pretend to understand or know Japanese culture well enough, but to an outsider, a Westerner, often you know, there are aspects of Japanese culture that seem very strange or mysterious or weird, like to us. And it's all there in this book. She has this very interesting voice, and she basically refers to the store as a character, and she's in love with it. And it's just a bizarre. Once you realize that, the book just gets even weirder, and it has this really interesting ending. And I don't even really know how to describe it. Apparently it's based on like the woman was a struggling writer for a long time, and she did work in a convenience store for a long time. I'm not saying she fell in love with it, but it's kind of based on her own experience. But gosh, this is one of the weirdest books I've read in a long, long time. But incredibly memorable. Like, just so many of the things she says are just, they just fly in the face of anything even resembling normal conventions in society. And she just doesn't care. You know, she knows she's different and odd, and she doesn't care, you know. And it's just really, I don't know what to make of it, but it certainly has stuck out in my memory, you know.
So yeah, you can see how it would be like really memorable. It's like, gosh, you know,
it's so strange.
But maybe it has something to do with Japanese culture. Like, if you remember that documentary, you know, about the sushi guy, Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
Oh, you know, that's a great movie.
It is a great movie, but like the only thing that matters literally is just making a better bite of sushi, you know, to this guy.
Yeah.
Yes. Like, you know, and I don't know, because I don't know enough about Japanese culture either. But you can see why that would be so memorable, though. Just the that's an audacious, at least to Western readers, even idea for a work of fiction, you know, somebody who just is like, you know, screw it. Like what I love in life is this convenience store, you know? Yeah. So, yeah.
So that would be, I mean, there are others, but that would be my list to kind of wrap things up.
Well, way to take things in a bizarre direction right at the end, John. Good for you.
Hey, no problem. I mean, I want to end things on an awkward note. So I think I achieved that.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, this is the Book Exchange Podcast. It can go anywhere, folks, and you don't know where it's going to go. Well, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it may lead you right up to the microwave where you're, you know, heating up a burrito.
That's right. Well, anyway.
All right. Well, that is our survey of some of our most memorable female characters, and as usual, went in all kinds of weird directions. That's how we do it here. Let's take this out quickly. Do you have a book you want to talk about? Well, I think you already did, right? What you're going to read next?
Well, I didn't mention it by name. I can mention it really quickly. So like I've said many times on this podcast, if you're somebody who's listened to our show for a while, I have an annual tradition where I read one book by or about Charles Dickens every year, which I've done since the year 2000, skipped over to the year 2001. But I went on a walking tour in London, Charles Dickens walking tour in London in the year 2000, many years ago, and it inspired me to read his books. That and a literature professor I had in graduate school around the same time who liked to reread Charles Dickens books. Those were the inspirations. So I read a book by Charles Dickens or about Charles Dickens every year. This year I happen to be going back to the first book I read when I made this kind of pledge back in 2002. So I you know, read a Dickens book in 2000. Then for some reason I didn't do it in 2001. And then 2002, I decided to do it annually. And that first year I read Charles Dickens's last completed novel called Our Mutual Friend. So now I've come back around and I'm going to read Our Mutual Friend again. That's what's coming up next for me, a nice 900 pager, John. So
there's another one, but you get so much satisfaction out of Dickens Fest every year.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I love it. I love doing it. I hope I do it till I kick it.
Nobody wants to rob you of that pleasure. The next book that I am reading, I'm really excited about. You were just talking about how, well, you're in the middle of right now, a science fiction book, The Kraken Awakes, I think it's called, John Wyndham. My next book is going to be a science fiction book. I don't even know if I've told you about this. And I'm super excited about it because I just got it recently. And it's a book by the great pioneering science fiction writer named Stanislaw Lem from Poland. He is the mastermind behind books like Solaris that became a film and the book that was adapted into another great film called Stalker, etc. He's got an incredible sounding book that I just picked up. It's called His Master's Voice. And it's basically about a scientist who is trying to figure out or write a program that will communicate with an intelligence beings from another solar system that has made contact with us. And he's working on a program that will help us communicate with them. And the program is called His Master's Voice. And it's all about like trying to make basically making contact with some extraterrestrial civilization. And, you know, that's the gist of it. It has a more interesting description that I don't have right in front of me, but you know, that's going to be just incredible. You know, that guy had an absolutely unbelievable imagination. And this book sounds like a real kind of precursor to where we are now in terms of like AI and what our artificial intelligence can do. So I think it's going to be a really wild book to read. So I'm really looking forward to that. So
that's a cool
little bit of science fiction up for me. And then, you know, that brings us to the end of the show. We do want to talk about our next episode, which is going to be our first episode of the year 2024. Jude, can you tell the listeners what we're going to be doing?
Yeah, it's really simple. So John and I have like this nerdy thing that we've been doing for many years where we kind of work pretty hard on this and we, you know, keep track all year of the books we read. And at the end of the year, we do a top 10 list like major newspapers do and media outlets, etc. We do a top 10 book list every year and share it with each other. And we're going to, and we've done this once before. I think we did this at the beginning of last year, if I'm not mistaken, or the year before. Yeah. So we're going to talk, we're basically going to discuss our top books of 2023 in the first episode of 2024. We're going to give an overview of our top 10 list. Probably won't talk about all 10, but we're going to give you an overview of our list and why they made our top 10 list. And it's going to be great. I've already done my list and kind of put it out there. And John usually comes along a little bit later and puts his together. And we're going to talk about our favorite books from 2023. So you don't want to miss it.
Yeah, I'm almost done with mine. And we try not to, like, if it's a book we've already discussed on the show, we'll you know, kind of briefly hit on it. But we'll try to choose ones that we, you know, maybe haven't given a lot of airtime to. So we'll see how it goes.
Right.
But this has become kind of a tradition for the show to just, you know, choose some of our favorite titles or the favorite books that we read from the last year. It doesn't have to be books that came out that year, not by any stretch of the imagination, but just the books that made the most impact on us. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And that does it for episode 63. Jude, thanks for another great discussion. And as always, I hope our listeners found something they could take away from this. And maybe it's a new book, a new writer, whatever it is. We appreciate you spending time listening to the Book Exchange.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. It's been a lot of fun, John, and let's do it again next time.
Sounds good to me. All right, Jude, until next time, you take it easy.
All right, you too.
See ya.